Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and it is a sublime pleasure and real privilege to be able to present to you for the first time a young woman, and I mean young woman, with whom I have recently become acquainted and with whom I am enormously impressed. Her name is Natalie Winters. She is an investigative reporter with a relatively new outfit, the National Pulse, brought to us by the intrepid Rahim Kassam. She contributes to the National Pulse podcast, and you can find her frequently in The War Room, Steve Bannon's production, as well as on Twitter, amazingly enough. Follow her as I do, at Natalie G. Winters. Natalie, it is a delight to have you here. Welcome for the first time to Secure Freedom Radio. I hope it'll be the first of many visits with you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I definitely hope so too.
You are extraordinary in terms of the investigative reporting business because so few people seem to be practicing it any longer, and you do it with extraordinary skill. And we won't do justice to your body of work just in this particular program, unfortunately, but we'll give people a taste of it and why they should follow you at Natalie G. Winters and, of course, at the National Pulse. Because I want to talk with you about a subject that you have seemingly taken a special interest in and you've done a great job illuminating for the rest of us, and that is absolutely vital to our understanding of the challenges this country is facing at the moment from the Chinese Communist Party. And that is the Chinese use as part of their larger strategy of unrestricted warfare against this country in the pursuit of what they've described as people's war against it, of influence operations. Tell us a little bit about what that term means as it's practiced by the Chinese Communist Party, and then we'll jump into some of the specific examples of how they're wielding this weapon against us with great effect.
Sure. Well, it seems that nowadays everybody loves to say how, you know, China owns Washington, D.C. They buy and sell our politicians and our journalists. So what we really strive to do at the National Pulse is kind of footnote those statements and give people actual information, oftentimes coming from records at the Department of Justice or the Foreign Agent Registration Act filings themselves, to really bolster these claims and have people understand that in Washington, D.C., there are a lot of people who are frankly directly on the payroll of the Chinese Communist Party. And if there's one group of people that I would have to single out who play a very important role in the whole ecosystem of the United States, that would be the mainstream media. And for the last couple of months, that's what I've really focused my attention on and my attention to. I think probably the most egregious story that we have that really identifies some of the key players in what's called China's United Front, which is a government-backed effort to the tune of billions of dollars whose sole purpose is really to influence and really subvert American elites, American politicians. You see it in the form of American journalists. And there's been extensive reporting from the U.S. government on this issue. They identify it as an entity and an effort that aims to, quote, co-opt and neutralize basically anyone who has any power in the West and get them to push policies that align with the desires and the hopes of Beijing. So we had a story about a few months ago, which was how journalists from every mainstream media outlet, and I don't say that hyperbolically, if you look at the articles, you can see it's everybody from MSNBC to Washington Post to New York Times to CNN, down to even local news outlets in the Midwest, how they were taking trips to China in exchange for, quote, favorable coverage. And what I'm quoting is the Foreign Agent Registration Act. Again, this requires that anybody who's working on behalf of a foreign principal or a foreign government, they have to register with the Department of Justice. So what we unearthed from these filings was that journalists were either taking trips or private dinners, the trips being to China, and upon return, they would be forced to give them, quote, favorable coverage. And this was part of the organization, which is called the China-United States Exchange Foundation, which functions as part of China's United Front, part of their broader campaign to, quote, effectively disseminate positive messages to the media, key influencers and opinion leaders, and the general public regarding China, and more precisely, the Chinese Communist Party. So this is the kind of information warfare, frankly, I think it's disinformation warfare, that you're seeing, and that the Chinese Communist Party and their various influence groups are paying for journalists to go on nice trips. They present them with a very rosy view of China. These journalists toured not only military facilities, but they toured Huawei. They met with Chinese Communist Party officials. And what's even more interesting about this story, it's not right-wing conspiracy, not only because, as I said, it's all sourced from these Foreign Agent Registration Acts, which are up in the Department of Justice, but upon return, we actually tracked the articles that were written by these journalists. Again, the website for the China-United States Exchange Foundation has since pulled down the pages of the names of journalists taking these trips. But luckily, yes, right? But luckily, there's a something called our archive machine, and you can see older versions of web pages. So I was able to kind of tease out and pull out the names of some of these journalists. So I started looking at the articles that these people had written. And one of them was an op-ed entitled China Bashing is for Losers. That was my personal favorite. Other people you could see praising now on their Twitter feed, talking about how the Chinese Communist Party responded to COVID in a very comprehensive and fast manner while dunking on President Trump. And really what's also interesting is you saw this as swath of people. They were the ones who were really weaponized kind of in 2018 and really throughout the Trump administration to be the primary critics and naysayers of President Trump's tariff against China, which as we know was something that the Chinese Communist Party was really not a fan of. So really whatever the narrative issue was of the day, you could see these people being weaponized to push Beijing's narratives. And these aren't just random, you know, rank and file journalists. People who took these trips, you have Ezra Klein, Matthew Iglesias. Those are both the co-founders of Vox Media. You have a CNN political analyst who's, you know, on TV every other week. You can see the article up at the National Pulse. I can't list all the names because we might be here forever. But I think, is the most telling story when you talk about the influence operations happening, not just on Chinese shores, but on American shores, too, and how it's affecting what you consume on a day-to-day basis in your home.
This is such a fascinating insight into what the Chinese are doing and how they are manipulating our perceptions of the regime in Beijing and, you know, what our policies should be to it. We haven't begun to skim even the surface of this with you, Natalie. I'm very pleased to tell our audience that we will be having a longer visit with you. Our television program, Securing America, on the Real America's Voice Network over this weekend. And I look forward to that. But what I'd really love to do, if we could, is have you come back, maybe even for an hour, and drill down on all of this, because we didn't get to the Tsinghua Journalism Center that is used to actually train journalists in sort of how to report with Chinese characteristics, as they might say. That's for another day. But thank you for your time today and for the great work you're doing. Natalie Winters at the National Pulse, you and Raheem and the rest of the team are simply indispensable now to getting the truth out, particularly about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to. I salute you and look forward to having you back soon. Thank you for your time today. Next up, General Jerry Boykin on a very important warning that he and other retired military leaders have issued about the direction of our country and what must be done about it, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it's a distinct honor to say we are joined by one of the most decorated members of the United States military's special operations community. His name is Lieutenant General William G. Jerry Boykin, United States Army retired. He has served his country in a number of capacities, both in the uniform of the United States Army, of course, commanding as well as participating in all of its most distinguished special operations units, I think it's fair to say, and also working with the intelligence community in a number of capacities, including finishing up as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. He is an author. He is a convicted minister and a leader of the conservative movement these days, and one of the signatories of an exceedingly important letter that was issued yesterday by Flag Officers for America. Some 124 general officers like General Boykin and admirals, flag officers, have come together to issue a profoundly, well, trenchant and needed warning about the direction of our country. And it's great to have General Boykin with us to talk a little bit about the impetus behind this and the content of this letter. General, thank you very much for joining us, sir, and for all of your service to our country.
Well, thank you for having me on, Frank. You know I'm a radical now, according to the left's report today on this letter that we wrote. So you are a bold man just to have me on, I guess.
I am privileged to have you on, whatever you are, sir. You are a patriot. So let's talk a little bit about the content of this letter. It was clearly meant to establish that there's a problem with the leadership of our country. You've described it as socialist, Marxist, progressive in character, and that it is leading us in a very dangerous direction on a broad front. Talk about, as far as you're concerned, some of the most important of these points, maybe starting with this legislation known as S1 that is being rammed through the Congress to redefine our election processes.
Well, they've tried to put lipstick on this pig, but it's still a pig by calling it the For the People Act. But look, if this occurs, we will be a one-party system. If this is passed, we'll be a one-party system. There'll never not be another free and fair election, and the liberals, the Democratic Party, will dominate indefinitely on the political scene. So we believe that this has to be stopped, and there's a couple of ways that it can be stopped, but we're depending on Democrats now to hold firm on their convictions and their promises, particularly Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, not to eliminate filibuster. But if they do, just what we write about here in this letter today is going to become a reality, and we are trying to point out how dangerous that is.
And General, this bill was marked up in the Senate Rules Committee yesterday, and apparently on a straight party line vote, which means an equal number of Democrats and Republicans, it was sent to the floor of the Senate. I'm not quite sure how soon it will be taken up there, but unless those Democrats, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema specifically, seem the best candidates, hold the line, they will probably wind up abandoning the filibuster or carving it up to get this legislation through. And I think you and your colleagues are absolutely right to warn that that could be the end of our republic if it happens, because without free and fair elections, we don't have a representative form of government any longer, alas. But this is only one of the things that you've been warning about. I'd like to talk to you about the issue of the weaponization, not just politicization, really, but the weaponization of the United States military that we're watching play out under this Marxist sort of program of forcing critical race training and other radical ideas on the military and it seems, trying to drive out of it people who don't subscribe to those views.
Well, a guy called me last night, a retired major general called me last night to tell me about something that happened in the military just within the last few days. And a soldier had either on his dog tags or on his keychain or something, he had a little placard that said Molon Lebe. Molon Lebe in Greek is come and take. That is what Xerxes was told by King Leonidas at the Battle of Thermopylae, when Xerxes said, lay down your weapons and I'll let you go. And Leonidas said, come and take them, Molon Lebe. That is something that the military has never used it as an official slogan, but it is something that you'll see in a lot of places within our military. Come and take them. That's exactly the attitude you want our young soldiers to have. You want to take our freedoms? I took an oath to the Constitution of the United States to support and defend it. You want to take my constitutional freedoms? Come and take it. Come and take it, because I'm going to stop you is the ultimate meaning. And that kind of nonsense, because they took it, they told a soldier to take it off because it was racist. What is happening now is that this is totally out of control, not just in our military, but in our nation as a whole, to where everything becomes racist in the eyes of somebody that is trying to push this critical race theory, this 1619 program, and all of these social programs that are taking up training time, and dividing our forces. Frank, let me just say this. In the military, the weapons are not nearly as important as the cohesion and the morale of the men that are using those weapons. And when you set those men down, men and women, you set them down in the classroom and you say, all of you white guys, you are oppressors. All you black guys, you are being oppressed by these oppressors. Do you think that does anything to build cohesion in the military? I am shocked at the Secretary of Defense, who spent his adult life in the military. I'm shocked that he's letting this nonsense go on and taking up training time where we ought to be out there preparing for war.
Not just letting it go on, General. I think it's fair to say he's leading the charge in terms of making the military submit to this kind of craziness. And you're absolutely right. Obviously, this is going to be the undoing of the institution in which you served with such great distinction for so long. And I can't help but say, sir, and I think this is the sort of leitmotif of your letter, that's the whole point. These Marxists are determined to take us down. They use race or racism, charges of it, systemic racism, and so on, as instruments of our undoing. And what could be a higher priority for our enemies, foreign and domestic, than ending the capability of the United States military with, you know, great effect and cohesiveness and integrity to stand up for and defend our country, to deter our enemies first, but to defend our country if necessary.
Well, yeah, Frank, this is, look, you got to go back and look at what Marxism really is. If nothing else, read The Naked Communist that was written in 1958. But what Karl Marx called for in 1848, when he wrote the Communist Manifesto, is he called for revolution. And the revolution was based on two classes of people, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Well, now it is racial. That division that he called for, that would ultimately bring about anarchy and revolution and then allow the government to step in and restructure the whole government. It is now about race. And what he is doing is he's taking us back 50, 60 years, back to the Jim Crow era, because now what we're seeing is that division that is based along racial lines, and it is all being perpetuated in such a way that hopefully it will divide us to a point that it is almost irreparable. And you have to go after the military if you want society to make any major changes like this. You've got to go after the military.
Right, and they are hard at it. General, I wanted to close by just saying that your letter is of incalculable importance, I think, to our country. And interestingly enough, counterparts of yours, distinguished, prominent military leaders of France, wrote last month a similar, the French would call it cri de coeur, I think, really a warning, a call of the greatest urgency to their countrymen, fearful that their government, like ours, is now taking their country in a very perilous direction, to the point where they really fear its survival. I pray, General, that the very important warnings that you've issued, whether it's about the borders or the rule of law or China as an existential threat to this country, the need to get our energy policies right, especially in light of what's happening at the moment, voting integrity, not least voting integrity. All of these are so vital, and urgent course corrections are required. And I salute you again, both personally and corporately, for your leadership at this urgent moment in calling out this Marxist direction of our country under the Biden administration, and pointing out the ways in which it needs to be redirected with the utmost urgency. I hope you'll keep coming back to us, General Boykin, with updates on how this message is being received. We're seeing overwhelming numbers of French citizens responding to the call of their military leaders. I believe that Americans are similarly very much aligned with the direction that you're talking about, and we hope that you will be once again and very prominently leading our country in a more secure and resilient direction. Thank you, sir, for all you do, both at the Family Research Council and for the cause of freedom elsewhere. Keep up the great work, my friend. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Spencer about what's going on in Israel and the jihad that is underway there now.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a privilege to say we're joined by Robert Spencer, who is these days, among other things, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He was also the director of Jihad Watch and a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the author of some 21 books, including a number of bestsellers. Personal favorites of mine are The Truth About Muhammad and The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS. He also has written a book for the Center for Security Policy Press, Mass Migration in Europe, a Model for the U.S. Robert, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
You are perhaps one of the world's foremost experts on jihad, and I wanted to talk with you about its current, rather, well, appalling manifestation in the form of now a comprehensive array of attacks against the state of Israel by jihadis of various stripes and in various parts of the Middle East. Give us sort of your assessment of what is the ideological or theological underpinning of what's being done to the Israelis now, and then we'll talk about some of the ways in which it's manifesting itself.
Well, the ideological and theological underpinning is the same as has been in the past underpinning all of the attacks against Israel and wars against Israel. And that's summed up really by the Quran in chapter 2, verse 191, where it says, "Drive them out from where they drove you out." Now, in my book, The Palestinian Delusion, I give an abundance of evidence that the Israelis did not actually drive the Muslim Arabs out of the area that is now modern day Israel. But that is the mythology that is relentlessly spread among the Palestinian Arabs and their allies. And consequently, they believe they have a divine imperative, a command from God to drive the Israelis out. And the immediate cause is a chance that Hamas has seen to assert its power and to grow its base in light of a recent self-inflicted mistake by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who's in the 16th year of his four-year term as president, and he called for new elections. Then it became very clear that he wasn't going to win those new elections, and he called them off. And Hamas sees a chance to further assert the weakness of Abbas and their own strength against the Israelis, and that's the immediate cause of this conflict.
David Wormser was on the program yesterday, another of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, and he said there may also be another calculation. There is an Israeli Arab party in the Knesset that has broken with the other Arab-Israeli parties in the Knesset and indicated that it would be willing to actually become sort of part of a national government and work for the state of Israel instead of seeking its destruction, as the rest of them do, and that the effort here is to both intimidate them and destroy any chances that they may pull that off. But whatever the specifics are, Robert, I think your point is very important here, that this was not precipitated by the Israelis, and hence the kind of moral equivalence that the Biden administration has been exhibiting towards the Israelis on the one hand and the perpetrators of the violence against them is not just misplaced, it's obscene. Let's talk a little bit about what the jihadists are now doing when they can get their hands on Israelis, either in close quarters or from a bit of a remove, to destroy them, if possible.
Well, it's really extraordinary, the open bloodlust that we see coming out of the Palestinians, and it never seems to move the Obama-Biden team at all. They don't ever take any notice of it. But you have, for example, a Hamas Political Bureau member, the former Minister of the Interior, Fathi Hamad, and he recently called upon the people of Jerusalem to buy a knife for 5 shekels, which I don't believe is very much, and cut off the heads of Jews. And he quotes the Quran saying, "You shall find the strongest in enmity toward the believers to be the Jews," and is inciting the people to, in essence, just carry out random attacks against Jewish civilians. And this is the kind of thing that we're seeing in the Palestinian areas. As a matter of fact, recently an American citizen, a Palestinian American, murdered a Jewish teenager. And it was noted in the reports on this incident that he was a wealthy, upper middle class individual. And so this once again gives the lie to the idea that terrorism is something that comes out of desperate poverty, and we need to give more billions to the Palestinians to solve the problem.
In addition to, you know, the $1.50 equivalent, I think, is what 5 shekels amounts to, of, you know, murderers at close quarters. We also have Hamas now sending hundreds of rockets into Israel in an indiscriminate way, some of them falling on civilian areas with murderous effect. They're also, Robert, launching them from civilian areas in Gaza. Talk a little bit about the bloodlust, even the lust for blood of their own people, because inevitably that puts civilians in the crosshairs of retaliation if the Israelis are not, as they tend to be, very exacting in what they target in retaliation.
Well, that's actually right. That's exactly the point in this case, that what they want to do is put their civilians in harm's way and get some of them killed. This is actually what they're calculating will happen and hoping will happen, because then they can use the deaths of those civilians to further the lie that Israel is indiscriminately and disproportionately killing Palestinians. And it going in because of a few rockets that didn't kill anyone, supposedly, and killing children and raising schools and all this sort of thing. And actually, they deliberately launch attacks from civilian areas so that the retaliatory fire can be used for this kind of propaganda purpose. Even the UN, which is inveterately anti-Israel, has noted this and condemned Hamas for doing it.
And yet they continue to enable it in part through their UNRWA program, the UN Welfare and Relief Agency. Let's talk, Robert, about one other piece of this, which is, I think, particularly alarming to both Israelis and those of us who revere the Jewish state and value its strategic alliance with this country. And that is, it seems now as though Israeli Arabs, who are not only represented in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, as I mentioned, but, you know, enjoy essentially a very privileged status in Israel, certainly compared to how Jews are treated in Arab states, Muslim states, and compared to how, for that matter, Arab Muslims are treated in their own countries elsewhere. But what's happening now, it seems, Robert, is not just that Palestinians from the West Bank or other areas that are, you know, outside of the wall that the Israelis created to try to defend themselves against Palestinian terrorism, but Israeli Arabs themselves are now mounting these attacks, pogroms they're being described as in some of the cities in Israel, burning synagogues, for example, and ambushing, you know, people in their cars and beating them or worse. What does that portend in terms of not just the jihad, but the likelihood that this is going to metastasize much more widely into perhaps war?
Oh, yes. War is very possible at this point. Of course, Israel has already said that it's going to go into Gaza and try to cripple Hamas once and for all, which, of course, it should have done many other times in the past. And that could lead to Hamas's allies, including or perhaps primarily the Islamic Republic of Iran, actually going to war against Israel. And so this is the world that Joe Biden has created and his handlers just in the space of a few months.
That's such a critical point, and I'm afraid it's going to be obscured. While I think many of us will find unacceptable the idea that there is some sort of moral equivalence between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which has been the principal response of the Biden administration to date, this idea that how they've been conducting themselves in seeking to appease and engage and otherwise embolden the Iranian regime on the one hand, and now restoring this corrupt Palestinian kleptocracy to a prime role in U.S. Middle East policy is indeed predictably giving rise to these kinds of, well, misbehavior, to put it gently, especially the idea that we've now put, as I understand it, several hundred million dollars back in the bank accounts from taxpayers in this country of these kleptocrats in Ramallah. Just quickly, in summary, Robert, holding the Biden team accountable seems to be vitally important if we're to avoid this problem getting much worse.
Well, you see, the Trump administration had completely pacified the area by bypassing the Palestinians, defunding them, and brokering peace deals between Israel and its neighboring states. Now, by newly empowering and financing the Palestinians, Biden has brought us to the brink of war and damaged those peace agreements because, of course, countries that were leaning toward Israel now believe they have to stand with the Palestinians. And so he has done nothing but inflamed the region and perhaps even created the groundwork for a full-scale war.
We need an urgent course correction. Robert Spencer, I hope your counsel is heated on this matter, and we'll look forward to taking it again soon. Thank you for your time today, my friend. God bless you and the great work you do at jihadwatch.org. Check it out, folks. Next up, Benjamin Weingarten on the racism of anti-racism. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special, very personal welcome to our next guest. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is one of the brightest lights in the firmament of the conservative movement, particularly the new generation of people who are incredibly influential and insightful, and I think leading in the effort to try to address what's ailing our country at the moment and get corrective action taken. He does this from a number of platforms, notably as a senior contributor to The Federalist, a terrific online resource. He is a prolific author, not only of these essays, The Federalist and elsewhere, but also of a really important book, American Ingrate, a book about Ilhan Omar. We'll talk with him about her in a moment. But first, Ben, a proper welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And not only I appreciate so much your work at The Federalist, but also at Newsweek, and the chance to follow you as I do at B.H. Weingarten. Good to have you with us again, sir. Welcome back.
The feeling is mutual, and I greatly appreciate that most kind introduction, Frank.
Well, it's actually both heartfelt and deserved. Let's start with Ibrahim Kendi. He is a character out of a novel, it seems to me, Ben. You've studied a bit what he's up to in terms of so-called anti-racism and how this fits into kind of the larger agenda of the Marxist left to use racism and charges of it to take down our country. Who is this man and what is he doing in that regard?
Yeah, I profiled Ibram X. Kendi recently for The Federalist, and I'd urge everyone to check it out. And my goal of that article was basically to say that, look, anti-racism, so-called anti-racism, and he's written what's considered one of the major tomes on the subject, How to Be an Anti-Racist, is essentially cloaking Marxism and bigotry, incidentally, racialist bigotry, under the guise of fighting purported bigotry. And given that Ibram X. Kendi is someone who Jack Dorsey of Twitter has lavished $10 million on for his university anti-racist research post, and he's been feted across the media, put on CBS, I believe, the day after the Chauvin verdict came in. We're basically living in Ibram X. Kendi's America, is my argument, as we see wokeism pervading basically every aspect of the federal government, corporations, universities, and every other influential pillar of society as well. So I set out to determine who is this man and what does he believe? And essentially, what we came to is anti-racism, again, is an ideology which not only advocates for discrimination in service of quote-unquote equity, which the anti-racists describe as essentially creating outcomes in society proportional with group percentages of the population, but that they're willing to use any and all means to achieve it. And that essentially would eviscerate equality in all of its forms: equality under the law, equality of treatment, equal enforcement of the rule of law, and beyond. And Kendi himself, of course, supports the whole leftist, radical, racialist agenda, including being expressly anti-capitalist, promoting discrimination in society to achieve his desired outcomes, and beyond. So anti-racism is a recipe for disaster for the country. It lies at the heart of the woke movement that is pervading this country, and that the elites in this country are cynically promoting and endorsing and imposing upon us. And ultimately, it will tear apart the fabric of the country under the guise of justice, virtue, and fighting racism, by turning all of our institutions on their head.
And that is the object of the exercise, I would argue. And I'm so glad you focused in on this point about the end of equality. This is one of the things that they are essentially packaging in this term equity, which they're constantly advancing, those on the radical left, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Ibram Kendis of the world, the critical race theorists. Equity is essentially not equality. It is preferential treatment of some individuals. It's racism, as you call it, Ben Weingarten, and I'm so glad that you have said so boldly. One of the adherents to all of this, of course, is the American ingrate, the woman that you've profiled in your terrific book about Ilhan Omar. Talk a little bit about her role in this movement, and as a sort of segue to our next topic with you, Ben, her specific charges that Israel is engaged in a sort of racist, apartheid persecution of the Palestinians because they are Muslim and of a different ethnicity.
Well, first on the, I guess, sort of narrower aspect of Ilhan Omar being the representative par excellence, the living personification of the intersectionalist, wokest milieu that dominates not only among the progressive cohort, and it's really critical to say this, but the entire Democrat Party, led by at least its leading figurehead, Joe Biden, who incidentally, right around day one of his presidency, put forth an executive order calling for enforcing equity, quote unquote, in every aspect of the executive branch. And that was really critical. The triumph of equity over equality means the evisceration of equality. And I wrote an article about this, but the equity agenda, so-called, what are some of the policy planks of those who support it, including Ilhan Omar? Defunding, if not abolishing, the police, open borders, abolishing ICE in connection with open borders, explicit anti-capitalism. Ibram X. Kendi himself says that to truly be an anti-racist, you have to be an anti-capitalist, and vice versa, as well as, of course, the anti-school choice agenda, keeping schools closed, keeping people locked in horrible situations, essentially.
Breaking up the nuclear family, too, another agenda item
nuclear
of the
family,
Marxists.
Of course, and the BLM platform since corrupt, naturally. And so you have an element of essentially destroying, actually completely undermining their charge of trying to create equity, because all of these policies end up hurting most those who the woke came to care about the most. But then you have the internationalization of this sort of movement. And of course, you know, it sort of goes with the rhetoric that the likes of Bernie Sanders and others have used, where essentially they say that Israel, amazingly, is the white supremacist, right-wing extremist state par excellence. This is a country which is the most liberal and free country and our closest ally infinitely in the Middle East, which has shared values, principles, interests, and well beyond that, in a sea of tyranny, Islamism, and authoritarianism, a bulwark of Western civilization. So naturally, it draws the ire greatest of Ilhan Omar and like-minded folks. We've seen various BLM chapters, Black Lives Matter chapters, that is, come out in solidarity with the Arabs of Palestine in conjunction with the attacks being foisted against Israel right now and Israel's retaliation against those attacks, which any country ought to do. But because Israel is held to a different standard, it shows the bigotry of its adversaries, its opponents. And Ilhan Omar and the woke cohort more broadly attacking Israel, I think, illustrates the fact that they hate the representatives of Judeo-Christian Western civilization par excellence, led by Israel. And that was one of the arguments in my book, actually, is that Israel draws the most ire and the sort of first brunt of the attack from these anti-American wokists, precisely because it represents the pinnacle of Judeo-Christian Western civilization. And it's the leading line, bulwark of it, against a world that is largely tyrannical, but in particular, an Islamist authoritarian region in the Middle East that is tyrannical and anti-Judeo-Christian Western civilization. So that in part explains this sick nexus that we see, which of course undermines America's national interests first, because they always put America last.
And Ben, stitched into all of this, as you make clear in your profile of this woman who came from Somalia, who has been clearly imbued with the Sharia supremacism of that country and of the expat community of Somalis, not all of them, I'm sure, but many of them, including some who have gone back to Somalia to fight with al-Shabaab, a jihadist terrorist organization there. Ilhan Omar not only brings this virulent anti-Americanism born of her Marxist sort of proclivities, but she also has this Sharia supremacist Muslim Brotherhood, you know, strain to her anti-Americanism as well. And the combination of the two, the red-green axis, as we've come to call it at the Center for Security Policy, is absolutely toxic. And I'm so appreciative of all that you have done to call her on it and to help the rest of us understand that this representative from Minnesota is really playing for the other team, or teams, as the case may be. And her agenda of equity, like that of Kendi and these others, is anathema, not only to us and our values, but to the future course of our country, if it's to survive as a free republic. Ben Weingart, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us soon, if you would. Hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.